The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsensewealth.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
I think what's biting the market is the continued strength in United States 10-year Treasury yields. So I think that's the amber flashing light. And going back to the early 70s, the 10-year Treasury yield is undefeated as an indicator. And so far, the 10-year Treasury yield is making a bid to have another knockout, because every time it has rallied sharply since the early 70s, something has broken and broken importantly. So I think this is a key thing to pay attention to. And I think until quite recently, the Fed thought that they were smarter than the bond market, but the bond market's always smarter than the Fed. The bond market's smarter than everybody.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
This week, significant market movements were influenced by key economic indicators such as GDP and inflation data, along with earnings reports from leading tech companies. Following a six-day decline in major stock indices, stocks rebounded strongly this week, buoyed by strong investor reactions to earnings releases from Microsoft and Alphabet. Despite some concerns surrounding Meta Platforms' guidance and the advanced GDP report on Thursday, stocks finished the week on a positive note. Meanwhile, bond markets experienced continued selling pressure driven by the economic reports and mixed outcomes in Treasury bond offerings. Earnings had a big part to play in the market this week. We heard from several bellwether names in the industrial, technology, and communications sectors. By the end of this week, nearly 40% of the S&P 500 companies will have reported on their first quarter results. Many provided guidance on the current quarter. Key earnings reports that shifted momentum back in the bullish category came from Texas Instruments on Wednesday, and that was followed by Microsoft and Alphabet's investors' reactions after the close on Thursday and into Friday's trading. There were some disappointments as well in earnings this week coming from Meta Platforms, IBM, Caterpillar, and Intel, but the bias was mainly to the upside. Texas Instruments was a standout winner in the semiconductor space, up 5.6% following results and receiving a price upgrade from TD Cowen. The company beat expectations and guided in line with expectations for the following quarter, but the company's comments on the industry had a widespread impact that has rebuffed comments earlier in the season from Marvell, ASML, Broadcom, and Taiwan Semiconductor. Texas Instruments said some industrial customers are nearing the end of an inventory correction cycle, which has bullish implications on demand. The Philadelphia Semiconductor Index closed 1.1% higher on the day as a result. While the initial investor reaction Thursday to Meta Platforms' earnings was bearish, it actually had bullish implications for semiconductors, which is the Wall Street darling in the new AI age. Meta closed the book on its year of efficiency and has communicated well that they are gobbling up AI chips from NVIDIA. This year's CapEx guidance was raised substantially from a range of $30 to $37 billion to $35 to $40 billion, which is eclipsing their great first quarter results. The stock was up 38% prior to its earnings announcement as earnings jumped 114% and revenue grew 27%. But if you follow the company closely, there was another period of heavy investing in the second half of 2021 and in 2022 that sunk the stock from, again, the CapEx spending. So investors have seen this cycle before for the company. And looking at the earnings announcement through a glasses half full perspective, the heavy investment in AI and chips will benefit the semiconductor industry. While the stock was down around 13% Thursday on the initial news, the rest of the market was able to rebound nicely. Alphabet and Microsoft were able to impress investors Friday after the reports Thursday afternoon, with their earnings reports and progress being made on AI growth, leading to a strong close in stocks for the week. Alphabet was helped not just from its results, but also from announcing a $70 billion share repurchase plan on top of its first ever cash dividend of 20 cents. Alphabet made impressive progress in advertising and cloud services, clearly communicated how Gemini, its AI technology, is being implemented in each of these areas. Cloud operating income surged $900 million from $191 million in the year earlier, and ad revenue jumped 21% to $8.09 billion. Microsoft reported its fifth consecutive double-digit earnings surprise. AI adoption has been key in their driver and growth for our Azure, which grew 31% constant currency compared to 28% prior guidance, while the company is seeing the number of 100 million plus deals up 80% year over year. The company also announced higher CapEx spending this year compared to the last, so the key to watch in future earnings announcements will be its margins going forward, as Wall Street has a scrutiny eye towards those results like we saw in Meta this week. Amazon announces next week and is up significantly already since its October low, but the growth in Microsoft this week is looking favorable on the name, with Amazon trading back above its 50-day moving average on Friday. It wasn't a rosy picture for all the stocks this week. Boeing, Humana, IBM, Intel, Caterpillar, Nucor, and Packaging Corp were down following their earnings announcements. IBM was down 8.3% following its earnings announcement, likely as a result of the revenue miss on expectations, as well as the announcement it will acquire HashiCorp, a multi-cloud infrastructure automation company, at a 40% premium following its market price, right around reports of a possible deal. However, IBM has a great track record with its mergers and acquisitions. Just look at Red Hat. Intel beat earnings, but guided down on second quarter earnings. The company said it sees the first quarter as the bottom and is expecting sequential revenue growth based on the company, which sees the PC market expanding, data center recovery and normal CPU buying, and cyclical recoveries in NEX, Mobileye, and Altera. However, the stock was down 9.5% last I checked Friday. On the economic front, the key market moving announcement was the unimpressive initial first quarter GDP report of 1.6% growth, down from the prior quarter's growth of 3.4%. It was disappointing if you look at the read on growth, and the report also contained higher inflation numbers. Coupled with the drop in unemployment claims, the GDP announcement is being read as a stagflation report, which will not make things easy for the Fed. The Fed's preferred inflation report came out on Friday, starting off with March personal income, which was up 0.5%, while March PCE prices were up 0.3%, matching the prior month's growth. Core prices were also up 0.3%, minus food and energy. Progress on inflation has stalled, clearly, but the news didn't really shift the narrative from prior inflation reports and Fed commentary early in the month away from the idea of two rate cuts later this year. The weak GDP print, along with Meta's earnings report, led to a steep sell-off at the open Thursday, but stocks were able to recover, heading into expectations for Microsoft and Alphabet's earnings, as well as on the continued rebound in semiconductors based on Texas Instruments industry comments and on the arms race by megacap tech buying AI chips. The 10-year Treasury yield saw a modest increase this week, driven by economic reports and mixed auction outcomes. It peaked at 4.73% before stabilizing right around 4.67% by Friday. Meanwhile, the 2-year yield remained relatively steady at around 5%. A successful auction of $69 billion in 2-year notes on Tuesday demonstrated strong demand. However, Wednesday's record $70 billion offering of 5-year notes received weaker interest. Thursday's auction of $44 billion in 7-year notes did see solid demand like the 2-year auction. Short-term rates, again, held steady, while long-term rates experienced a slight uptick during the week. This week's recap highlights a strong rally in stocks led primarily by the tech sector, fueled by positive reactions in semiconductor stocks on CapEx news and on earnings announcements from Microsoft and Alphabet. Economic data is indicating signs of stagflation, initially causing the stocks to dip on Thursday following that GDP report. However, investors appear to be adjusting to the stagnation inflation scenario, evident from Friday's response to the PCE prices report. Looking ahead to next week, we anticipate more earnings releases as we enter the second week of major announcements from influential market bellwethers. Up next, this week's guest technician, John Roque.
Take nuclear power. Biggest source of clean energy. It employs over 60,000 workers, including many of you. The key to meeting the goal of 100% clean power grid by 2035 depends a lot on it. That's why we're keeping existing plants open, restarting shuttered plants, and building America's first new nuclear plants in decades.
Nuclear power is being embraced more and more. So what we're seeing right now is in a Western world, because in the East, we've seen China, South Korea, Japan, India, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Turkey. We've seen all these countries all really embrace nuclear power as a clean, reliable source of energy. But we're now also seeing the West now really turning around. And of course, electricity demand is growing, but these massive data centers, like these Microsofts and Amazons and Googles that all want to build these massive data centers, these data centers will consume around 30 to 40 gigawatts of power just in the US by 2030. That is an enormous amount of growth.
To listen to this full interview and gain access to all of our premium content airing during the week, where we discuss markets and big investment trends, often well before they reach the mainstream news, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsensewealth.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, on Thursday, the government announced GDP numbers for the first quarter. They fell to an anemic rate of 1.6%, while inflation ticked up to 3.7%. Well, the market didn't like the news, with big sell-offs in the major indexes. Let's find out what all this means. Joining us on the program from 22V Research is John Roque. John, let's begin with the day we're talking, where we've got a big sell-off going on in the market, based on the economic and inflation news that came out on Thursday.
So I think what's biting the market, irrespective of what happened today, I'm not saying that that's not important, but I think what's biting the market is the continued strength in the United States 10-year Treasury yield and in the yield curve in general. So I think that's the amber flashing light. And going back to the early 70s, the 10-year Treasury yield is undefeated as an indicator. The only heavyweight champion to retire undefeated was Rocky Marciano. And so far, the 10-year Treasury yield is making a bid to have another knockout, because every time it has rallied sharply since the early 70s, something has broken and broken importantly. So I think this is a key thing to pay attention to, and we should not be, you know, so complacent about its action.
Yeah. What does this mean also for the Fed? Because I know we went from 6 rate cuts, then they were thinking about 3 rate cuts. Now that's off the table. And you've got former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers talking about maybe we need a rate hike.
That's very curious. I'm going to try to not be so critical of the Fed, except for the following items. Number one is I think they talk too much. And I think I prefer my central bankers to be fairly anonymous and quiet. Almost like a Buford Pusser in Walking Tall. Walk tall and carry a big stick, but otherwise keep quiet. And I think they cornered the market participants into believing that there would be, you know, quite a number of rate cuts. And I think until quite recently, the Fed thought that they were smarter than the bond market. But the bond market's always smarter than the Fed. The bond market's smarter than everybody. I worked for 4 years at Soros Fund Management, and Robert Soros, George Soros' son, said to me in 2012, John, the bond market never lies. And he's right.
Yeah, because I'm just looking at Treasury yields right now. You've got the 2-year note over 5%. You've got the 3-year note almost at 4.9. And as you talked about, the 10-year note, 4.7, and 30-year bond at 4.8. I mean, that sounds ominous here.
Well, I know you'll remember this, but I'll just repeat it. The last time the 10-year yields moved from just under 4% in July 23 to 5% in October 23, the Dow was down 9%, the S&P equal weighted was down 14%, the Russell 2000 was down 17%, and the KBW Bank Index was down 20%. The only sector that rose during that time was energy. So I know that history doesn't repeat in detail, but given where rates are, I think it's prudent to be a little cautious here.
Yeah, and let's speak of energy. We've seen oil prices go up to 85, 86, and Brent briefly touched 90. We're roughly in the 82, 83 range. But John, I don't know where you live, but in California, I'm paying $5.50 for gasoline.
Yeah, this is I think is another issue. I think the commodities are improving, and I think higher energy prices have always been kind of a drag on consumer discretionary spending. So it wouldn't surprise me if, given where rates are and given what oil has done and given what people are paying for gas, as you mentioned, Jim, that consumer discretionary stocks might be in for, somewhat of a rougher go.
Well, let's talk about technology stocks. Last year, 2023, was a story about the Mag 7, but the Mag 7 aren't looking as magnificent. A lot of these stocks are breaking down. NVIDIA is come down. It's probably holding up the best out of the seven, but let's talk about that.
Okay, so just to put what you said into perspective, I maintain what I call a technical scoring system, and I can score anything that has a price. And the scores help me to remain objective about what I'm looking at, not subjective. And every Friday, I conduct a review of about 125 tech stocks. And as of March 22nd, this portfolio of 125 stocks had nearly 70% of them with strong readings on my work. As of last Friday, this figure had deteriorated to 37%. So it's down 32 percentage points in the last month. That gives you an idea what's happening underneath the surface for technology stocks. And I think the higher rates are biting, high multiple stocks. And just to add into this, to present a little more evidence, over the last month, utilities are up about 4.5% and tech is down almost 7% over the last month. So there's a problem here that tech is taking it on the chin with respect to higher rates, but utilities are not. That's a little strange to me.
Yeah, and if you look at within the S&P 500, utilities are going up. You've got, consumer discretionary staples.
Staples, right.
Yeah, so it seems like a little bit more defensive at this point.
I agree with you. The staple stocks have had a big, sharp rally, even ones that were, let's say challenged on my work. So I imagine that some folks have quickly gotten into a defensive posture by using utilities and staples. I agree with that.
And one thing that we're also seeing here, John, for the longest time, for almost a decade, cash was trash. But as you and I were just talking about treasury yields, you got the 2-year at 5% and you have T-bills over 5%. So if you just want to be a little defensive and go to cash, at least you're getting paid for that today.
Listen, I agree with you. I think 5% risk-free on the short end of the yield curve is not crazy. I really think that's a pretty good deal. 5% over 12 months, that's not bad.
Yeah, and no state taxes for those correct. Living in California really makes a difference. I want to talk about something that we've seen break out. There was last year there was a period where gold was struggling, but it held above 2,000. And then a couple of weeks ago, we saw it touch basically, I think it was 2,500 on a Friday, and silver briefly touched 30. They pulled back with the increase in margin. Let's talk about gold, and then I want to talk about the miners. Yesterday, BHP made a bid for Anglo American. So let's talk about gold and silver in basically commodities.
So I'm sure you and your listeners will know that, gold is the king of all commodities. You can't have a commodity bull market without gold, and gold is a leader here. So history would suggest that commodities as a whole should start to do better. You also can't have a gold bull market without a silver bull market. And generally, when you have a gold bull market, you have a bigger silver bull market in terms of percentage. Although silver is not for the faint of heart. It goes up really sharply and it corrects just as sharply. But both metals, both gold and silver, have been, basin breakout metals going back to the 70s. So I think that's the position that they find themselves in right now. They both had big moves, as you alluded to. Gold went from 2,000 to recent highs, roughly 2,400 or thereabouts. And silver touched 30. So it wouldn't surprise me if both metals started to consolidate a little bit here. But I think they still look pretty darn strong on my work.
Somebody sent me a chart looking at September 2010 to April of 2011, a silver chart, and saying it's following a similar pattern. I wonder if you'd comment on that and maybe call it up on your screen if you see that.
So the comparison is between 2010-11?
Yep.
Well, from 2008, let's just call it spring of 2008 until September of 2010, silver was bounded on the top side by 20. It had gotten down in the GFC as low as almost $8. But let's just remember that 20 was the upside or top side resistance. When it broke through 20, it rallied to nearly 50 in early 2011. Silver has been sideways now this period from August of 2020. So it's nearly 4 years sideways with 30 as the top side or upside resistance. So getting through 30 would imply, you know, a reasonable, not hyperbolic target of 40. Silver's move the last time was much more, much sharper, I guess because it had come off of that big GFC low. So silver from the low was almost 8 to then it got to 50. This time it might not have that, you know, big kind of trampoline effect because it didn't get as low. So I think a reasonable first target on a breakout above 30 would be a $40 target.
And let's talk about gold. Where do you see gold going given its present pattern?
So my first target for gold when it got above 2064 was 2444. And that was pretty darn lucky because I think it got to within $12 of that target quite recently. So it got to 2432. So that was a 2444 was pretty darn close. So I think it needs to consolidate again. I don't want to go with another upside target because I'd rather do it on a legitimate breakout above 2444 because I think gold probably does need to consolidate here after running from 2000 to 2400 in about 2 months.
All right, let's talk about something. We briefly touched upon it, but let's talk about oil prices. We're heading into the summer driving season where you have greater demand for gasoline, more people taking vacations, traveling, getting in their motorhomes. Where do you see oil? What does that look like to you?
So my first target for oil was 90, and it got pretty darn close. I'm going to stick with that right now. There's resistance for the price of crude going back to September and October of 2023, right around 90 bucks. So maybe oil has to pull back a little bit here and consolidate, but I think it gets the benefit of the doubt for higher prices. So I'm going to stick with it here. I know it's in a little bit over the last 2 weeks, but I think it's still right to stick with it.
You know, something that we're starting to see, you saw the price of gold go up, the miners were lagging, and then just a little over 3 or 4 weeks ago, the miners started to take off. What I'm seeing in the mining sector, and this goes yesterday, when BHP announced a takeover of Anglo American, it sounds like the miners are doing the same thing that the oil companies. Last year, we saw Exxon, we saw Chevron make plays. Rather than drill, they're doing their drilling on Wall Street. It sounds like the miners are starting to do the same.
Well, that would create, with BHP and Anglo American, the world's largest copper mining company. Of course, they mine for other things, iron ore, base metals, et cetera. And I'm pretty sure that Anglo owns De Beers, which is, of course, the diamond mining. So I think this is a little bit different, but I'm as encouraged as you are to think that there might be some consolidation there and a more important interest in the miners. And I know you were alluding to it, and I'll just follow on with your train of thought, I think. I'm glad finally that the gold miners have participated. If you look at the XAU index, that's the Philadelphia Gold and Silver Index, it's moved from roughly 105 in early March and it got to 145 about 2 weeks ago. And here it is at 135. I think it's consolidating. So I like the action here. I'm glad the miners are finally participating. I don't know why they've lagged the metal, especially gold, so much. Maybe there's just been a great lack of interest when you didn't need them because you had the Big Seven, Magnificent Seven, and SMCI, MSTR, a lot of stocks going up to a great degree. You didn't need them, but I'm glad to see that these are now in the game along with the parent metals of gold and silver.
Yeah, as we speak, we're seeing a nice jump in GDX today, which are a collection of miners, small and large. So, I mean, this is something that really stands out.
I think they're let's use your GDX, which I think is a great representation. It went from 26 to almost 36 in a month and a half. But realistically or accurately, it's actually been sideways now for 3 weeks, which I think is an encouraging sign. So you're, the price now is not really any different than it was in early April, around April 5th. And I think this is telling us that this group, this GDX and the underlying are consolidating. That's a good sign. And it wouldn't surprise me, Jim, if this worked from where we are here to a $40 price, which is the resistance from early 2022. And then it's kind of, you know, first part of 2021. But I think that's a reasonable assessment from this level here.
So let's move on to back to interest rates from treasuries to corporates. I mean, we've been buying some short-term corporates in the 2 to 3 year range. And John, we're getting over 6%. I can't remember for almost a decade when I ever saw 6%.
Jim, I think these are some great returns. I think they will likely provide competition for equity fund flows to a great degree, or to some degree at least. And I think it's hard to turn away at 6% on a corporate bond, much like it's hard to turn away 5% on a short-term treasury. I mean, these are legitimate competitors for equity money, with less risk, of course.
You know, and this is the thing that really strikes me. Jeremy Siegel just did an update to his book, Stocks for the Long Run. And he's saying, going forward over the next decade, figure an 8% return. And, you know, you had Jim Grant of Jim Grant's Interest Observer saying, you know, it's finally nice to have something to observe again. But when you can get 6% and get almost 65, 70% of the long-term return in stocks, and without the volatility in safe, that's not a bad deal.
I agree with you, Jim. And I think this is kind of an unusual period. And I'm going to just say the following, and I don't know if you or your listeners will agree, but there's a whole host of investors, both professional and, you know, let's call them retail, who have never seen before a rising rate environment. And so I think that there are, you know, kind of unfamiliar how to navigate this environment because they're used to one decision kind of approach, which is, of course, buy equities and buy tech. And it's worked spectacularly. There's no criticism there. But I think because this environment is a little different, they have to navigate the waters a little bit more carefully. You know, and then in line with that, I would say, and this is not a hyperbolic statement, there's probably five people still around in the business who have ever made real money, owning gold and silver. And I think this is another part to this, another input to this environment that most people are not comfortable with because they haven't been around long enough to have seen a prior cycle where gold and silver have rallied so dramatically. So I think gold, silver, treasuries, and corporates are other items that investors should consider. And, you know, I can understand if they haven't yet considered them because they didn't need to, but I think they're going to have to.
Yeah, this is the, you know, if you take a look at, John, the last decade, I mean, all you had to do is just simply put your money in index fund. The market went up every single year. You could almost put it on autopilot. This decade reminds me very similar to what we saw between 1968 and 1981. You saw oil, you saw war in the Middle East, the overthrow of the Shah in 1979, inflation, the emergence of gold from 35 to 800, silver all the way up to 50. Any comments there on some similarities?
Well, that period was a very volatile period. The Dow Jones Industrial Average peak was roughly around 1,000 and it went sideways for about 16 years. You had higher inflation. You had higher commodity prices in general. In fact, Jim, I had a webinar of my own for our own clients and it was on December 17th. And the title of my webinar was Disco Inferno. And I wasn't choosing the word inferno because I was trying to be salacious. But I said, you know, Disco Inferno, which was a song by the Tramps in 1976. During the disco era, gold, the U.S. 10-year yield, and the CPI trended upward together. And I just wondered, you know, out loud to the people on my webinar, are we in another period where the gold, the CPI, and the 10-year treasury will trend upward together? But of course, with music that isn't nearly as good. And if the disco era is appropriate and your admonition is also appropriate, then maybe we're in for a period where stocks generally don't do very much. However, select sectors can do well without driving the overall market higher. So I think it's a reasonable, you know, backdrop, at least one to consider. And then with respect to the Jeremy Siegel, I'm not going to disparage him. I'm just going to, you know, kind of put a coda onto his comments. If you and I went back to any date in history from the 1920s forward, and then imagined where the market would be 1 year after that date, any date in history to 1 year forward, the market is up 1 year forward nearly 70% of the time over the last 100 years. No matter what date you choose in history, 1 year after that, the market is up nearly 70% of the time. The only two competing comments when it's not up 1 year later is when we're either A, in a bear market, or B, in a recession. So, you know, while Siegel's comments sound erudite, I think they're a little bit, on the face of it, quite obvious. You don't really have to do anything because the market is built up and 70% of the time you're going to be higher. You just have to pay attention when you have troubles with respect to recession, a bear market, or a period where you get rising rates. Now, I'm just going to verbalize this for you. And if you want the chart, I can send it to you and maybe you could put it on your website. But I'm just going to give you an idea. If you go back to 1970, there have been 16 instances in which the 10-year treasury yield has rallied sharply. Every time, each of those 16 periods has resulted in a big break somewhere. You might remember Franklin National, First Pennsylvania. There was a bear market in 1981, Penn Square Bank, which failed in the early 80s, then Continental Illinois in the kind of mid 80s, the 87 crash, et cetera. We could do this all day long. So it's important for investors to consider this, that the 10-year treasury yield is undefeated. And when it rallies, there's always a break. And that's the most important takeaway here, I think, from our discussion.
Couldn't agree more, John. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you at 22V Research, tell them how they can easily do so.
Well, you can contact Ryan Esner. That's R-E-S-S-N-E-R at 22VResearch.com, and he'll have a conversation with you. Thanks, Jim.
All right. Well, John, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Take care, my friend, and hope to talk to you once more.
Thanks, Jim. Talk to you soon.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939. Or you can also visit us on our website, financialsensewealth.com. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.